Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to Any Stupid Questions, the podcast where we ask experts the big questions that we ought to know the answer to, but come on, we've been busy. I'm Danielle Ward, and joining me today to talk about tourism is Dr. James Cannell, Principal Lecturer in Tourism, Events and Hospitality at Greenwich University. Hello.
Hello.
And asking the questions with me are comedians Nat Tapley and Jessica Fostercue. Hello.
Hello.
Hello. I apologise, first of all. I've got a very croaky voice. I'm trying to be sexy. You know how old witches are sexy. Ooh, that sexy cackle. That's what I'm going for. Anyway, hi, James. Nice to have you here.
Hello, thank you.
All right, so here's the first question that I want to ask you. Why do people visit the UK? Why? Why?
Oh, God. When you ask visitors why they come to the UK, the things they tend to say are the history, the heritage, the football. I mean, all the obvious things about the UK, the things that we never talk about when we talk about marketing the UK are the weather, yeah, and the food and the quite bad welcome that people get. And it seems that none of those seem to affect people. They still want to come anyway.
I will pull you up on this food thing. Yeah. Yeah. So I went to America and the Americans were all going, oh, British food's so disgusting, isn't it? Our American food's great. American food is weapons-grade disgusting.
And they give you loads of it.
Yeah. And they give you loads of it.
They add mayonnaise to anything and call it salad. Yeah. Pasta salad. That's not a salad.
I mean, maybe it's living in London. London food's really good. I don't know.
Yeah. There's a lot now with, like, markets and street foods and pop-ups and that sort of thing. And you get a certain kind of tourist who will come to London, especially for the food, because they come because we've got all these Michelin-starred restaurants or we've got Borough Market and that sort of thing. But generally, the English food that people come for is afternoon tea, cream tea, scones, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Fish and chips?
Mm. Fish and chips. People love fish and chips and they don't care whether it's by the seaside.
What?
Well, they're wrong on that.
They just think that
it's
fish
unacceptable
and chips,
anywhere else.
And they think that fish and chips is something you can eat anywhere and especially in London. So that they will happily come and queue up at, you know, what we'd think of as quite a grotty kebab shop because it also does fish and chips and feel like they're getting an authentic British experience. Yeah, fish and chips maybe.
So which bits of the UK are the really sexy bits to foreigners? When they're like, I want to come to the UK, apart from London.
The only real reason people come to the UK is for London.
Yeah, like, even though, but is it true? Because surely, looking at the president of the United States tweets, and come on, he is a voice of reason, you'd think London was a big violent shithole.
Yeah. I mean, luckily, no one believes Donald Trump about anything.
Okay.
So that's that. Well, apart from millions of Americans, but that doesn't seem to be putting people off. Other places are popular. So the Lake District is important because people associate it with poetry and beauty and those sorts of things. Yeah. Lots of people want to come to Scotland, especially Germans. Germans love Scotland.
Really?
Yeah.
What's the connection?
There was a story written. I can't remember the name of it, but in the 19th century, and it was a kind of a myth about the founding of Scotland and the links to Europe and Northern Europe and Germany and these ancient warrior traditions. And it just became part of the kind of German, sort of the equivalent of the national curriculum. So Germans grew up reading these stories about Scotland and learning about Scotland. So one of Scotland's biggest source markets is Germans.
Wow.
So it's like everyone in this country reading Tintin and deciding to go to Belgium all the time.
Yeah, exactly.
If I did an Edinburgh show next year in German, Would that have a big audience?
Yeah, they'd love it. They'd absolutely love it.
Do that.
Should definitely do. I mean, yeah. I don't speak German, but I could put some sausages on my knees or something. That's what they.
Yeah, it's just some German flyers.
Scotland is gorgeous, though. Yeah. Scotland, I don't know why
Scotland's
Scotland gets
beautiful. Yeah, I don't think that's as embarrassing as Ireland. What about Stonehenge?
Yeah, people do like Stonehenge. I mean,
it's their favourite henge.
It's the best of all the henges. I mean, if you look at the kind of marketing that Visit Britain do and the images they use, it's lots of stuff in London, and then it's Stonehenge, it's some Scottish stuff. It's a bit of Bath and the Roman baths. Yeah. Even though the Roman baths aren't Roman, they're Victorian. No one really talks about that. There's a bit of
cozy. It doesn't have the same ring to it, does Victorian baths.
Yeah.
Sound like somewhere you'd go and feel very shy about not wearing enough.
And there's a bit of seaside stuff, you know, there's quite a lot of nice pictures of the coast. But generally it's London that's the big draw.
You go to the British coast and you don't tend to meet people that aren't from Britain, as a rule.
They've seen other coasts.
Yeah.
They're aware that this isn't a very good coast.
Do people still go to Blackpool on holiday?
Millions of people go to Blackpool on holiday.
But there are other British people,
popular.
Right?
Yeah. It's a domestic tourism destination. I mean, they have other things going on. So they have a conference centre, they have music venues. They do have things that bring in international tourists. But primarily, it's still doing the same job it did 200 years ago, which is it's a domestic tourism destination for people in the UK.
And huge heroin problem.
Like most seaside towns.
Yeah, because it's floating on rafts. I don't know anything about heroin. Nat, have you got a question?
I do have a question. People say the Queen brings in lots of tourism.
Mm.
So would it be worth our while investing in five or six new queens?
I mean, if you had five or six new queens, if they all looked like the same queen and you put them strategically around the country...
Mm-hmm. One in Birmingham, one in...
Yeah. There are a lot of tourists who would never know they hadn't seen the genuine queen. So that might work.
Army of queen lookalikes.
You could give everyone the chance to see the queen, because tourists are always disappointed when they go to Buckingham Palace and everyone's looking to work out where the flag is and is she in, is she out. So yeah, you could position ersatz queens everywhere and shuttle people around. But yeah, the royal family is kind of important for tourism.
That's why I think we need more of them. More royal families.
But nobody really knows how important the royal family is for tourism, because... But there are lots of different reasons. One of the main reasons is it's really hard to find out, because it's not really in anyone's interest to give you the access to the information, to the statistics, because what if you find out they're not important to tourism? Mm.
That would be very sad.
That would be very sad, and a lot of people are getting really upset.
They've probably got about a week until they're murdered.
Yeah.
So there are no real figures out there. When there are surveys done of tourists to the UK, and they're asked, did you go to a royal property? Were you interested in the royal family? Then everyone says yes.
Mm.
No one really asks, were the royal family the main reason you came to the UK? It tends to be that the royal thing is just kind of in the mix.
Because you don't have to get rid of the palaces. I mean, they've still got Versailles in France, even though they cut their king's head off.
Even if we had the kind of smouldering ruins of Buckingham Palace after a revolution.
Oh, I'd go and see that.
I'd go and see that, yeah, exactly.
I love
and
a ruin.
And I guess also, like, the Queen has been around for so long, it's quite exciting to go and see. Is she, like, the oldest living monarch, longest reigning monarch who is alive?
I think so,
So that's really exciting. When she goes and you've got Charles...
Yeah.
It feels like a slightly less sexy proposition.
Yeah, you can't quite see people flocking to listen to him and see him, but...
But there was this, right, I don't know if you noticed, there was a really big wedding recently of a ginger man and a beautiful woman. Do people come to the UK just to line the streets for a wedding? Is that a thing that happens?
Some people do. There's no doubt about that. We do get some tourists who come just for the royal wedding.
Yeah.
And they're the kind of people who are probably at home, have kind of all the plates and all the tea towels, and they're waiting for this. And some tourists will time their visit to the UK to coincide with something like this.
Okay, yeah.
And the royal family are really good at staging these things at a really regular period. So there's a wedding, and then there's a jubilee, and then there's an anniversary, and then there's some kind of other event. You know? And so actually lots of tourists will come, but we're not talking massive, massive numbers. And if those tourists didn't come, it wouldn't really make any difference to UK tourism. And we had the FA Cup final on the same day.
Yeah.
Where you have like 90,000 people coming to Wembley Stadium and millions of people watching it on television, and it's broadcast all around the world, and none of it's funded through the public sector
at
all. But no one says, oh, what a brilliant thing it is that we have this for tourism.
But nobody cried at the FA Cup.
Oh, I don't know, Man United fans maybe.
Jessica, have you got a question?
Is it true that there's more money in tourism than in oil, food or cars now? And if that's the case, and we've got now a president of the US that's made his money in tourism, or some of it anyway, will we start to see more leaders from the tourism industry? What I'm really asking is Deborah Meaden the next PM?
would she do a worse job?
Who knows?
Celebrity politicians. I mean, some people will try and claim that the tourism industry is worth more than arms and medicine and things like this. It's probably not. I mean, it's definitely not in the
not
UK.
If you're ill, certainly. Yeah. Medicine's definitely more important.
Yeah, definitely more important. Tourism is probably the fourth or fifth biggest industry in the world.
Right.
It's responsible for around 1 in 10 jobs in the world, directly and indirectly. In the UK, it's responsible for about 8% of GDP, which probably puts it around the same as construction, but when you compare it to shipping or the arms industry, it's nowhere near. And the big problem for people trying to research it is that it's really hidden. Like when you walk around London, it's quite hard to see who's a tourist, who's a local. If you look at a business in the centre of London, if you look at a restaurant, how many of their customers are tourists? How many of their customers are domestic? How many of them are international? It's actually really hard to get a solid number for tourism, but about 1 in 10 jobs in the world for tourism. So it is really significant, and that's one of the challenges with trying to get people to take tourism seriously, is getting this number across.
Is there a more stark contrast between who's a tourist and who's not? When you're not in a big city then, I'm from a seaside town, it's really obvious when it's the summer or not.
Yeah.
Who's a tourist?
Yeah.
And who's not? It's school
holidays.
Who's
smiling and who looks utterly miserable.
Who looks like they're enjoying themselves.
Yeah.
In cities, in big metropolitan cities, it's virtually impossible to tell. In some countries, when you go on holiday, you have to hand in your passport at the hotel and they take a photocopy of it, and all the tourist businesses are registered. We don't have that in the UK. So if you want to start a business dealing with tourists, you don't have to tell anyone. You can just do it. So other countries have a better handle on how many tourists they get, where they stay, where they spend their money. We don't really know in the UK. But then, so I work in Greenwich, and in the summer, it's really clear that Greenwich is absolutely rammed with tourists. And it kind of doesn't matter whether you can see who the tourists are or not. What matters is that it's really busy and you can't get into the pubs and you can't get a table in the restaurant and there's nowhere to park a car. So you know when the tourists are there, but you can't always spot them.
Couldn't you just keep watching the entrance to M&M World? Those people are definitely the tourists.
The mysterious M&M World, yeah.
I live here at St Pancras International, where the Eurostar comes for people who didn't know that. And sometimes what I like to do is buy a croissant from the Marks and Spencers, sit on a bench with my eyes shut, and it's like being in Paris. It's nice. Always lots of French people.
But it's nicer than being in Paris.
Yeah,
the other end is not so good for the Gardenaur. I mean, London's done really well out of the Eurostar.
Yeah.
When you come off the Eurostar as a tourist, you feel like London is full of amazing shops and it's beautiful.
It's beautiful,
and there's someone there just playing a random piano.
Yeah.
And so, whereas you get off the train in Gardenaur and it's much more like there are three guys with machine guns and you're a little bit scared and the taxi drivers are all screaming at you.
Yeah.
It's different proposition.
Slightly different vibe.
Yeah. Yeah, a tiny bit
less romantic, if anything, ironically.
Oh, yeah, ironically.
So on the subject of tourism, because it seems like it's this very nebulous thing, tourism. So how much tourism is centrally planned with Visit England signs and subsidies, etc.? And how much is just a farmer putting some strawberries on a hay bale saying, come and visit Strawberry Land?
One of the big challenges for tourism planners is that it's really, really hard to control tourism. So you have people like Visit Britain, Visit England, and then at the local level, Visit Kent, Visit Yorkshire, and people trying really hard, not necessarily to control tourism, but to work out where it goes, where needs the tourism. People thinking about, should we have a hotel built here? Is that going to be good for local people? Is it all right to have these kind of businesses in this area? There are lots of people trying really hard to control this sort of thing, but then there is nothing stopping a farmer from just opening up something random, calling it a tourist attraction, putting up a sign and diverting all your tourists. There's a government department with responsibility for tourism. There's a minister for tourism. The funding for all of that has been cut really hard in the last 10 years, like everything. And tourism's a really soft target, as you'd expect. I mean, government's got to think about hospitals and education, all these kind of things. So the cuts to tourism are really hard. So that means that in places like Cornwall, where you know Cornwall is outside of London, is the most important tourist destination in the UK. Cornwall had, you know, 10, 15 people employed managing tourism, marketing tourism, running visitor centres, putting up signs, running websites. And that's basically been reduced down to one really enthusiastic, really great guy and his van.
Really?
And he's doing a fantastic job of promoting tourism. But you'd think that tourism in areas like that must be really, really well managed.
Yeah.
Whereas actually, to some extent, like, the government's kind of forgotten about it.
That seems a bit bonkers, really. I mean,
they've gone to the trouble of inventing the word staycation.
Yeah.
And then abandoned it.
Well, staycation was great when the economic crisis was kicking off in 2007, 2008, because it was a really great way of saying, like, you can't afford to go abroad, but have you thought about going to Skeggy?
Keeping your money here.
Keep your money here was a positive thing for the economy, but more realistically, it was you can't afford to take your money anywhere else.
Yeah.
So try and make a virtue of it. It's no coincidence that we have kind of glamping at the same time, the kind of luxury camping holidays. Butlins did really well. Holiday camps did really well at that period. But yeah, now that's all kind of disappearing a little bit as people have got a little bit more money in their pockets. All of that stuff seems to be vanishing.
Is it really a virtue if people end up at the Jamaica Inn Museum, which is essentially just a cabinet full of smuggling stuff? And they say, come in, pay some money, and you do, and you go in, it's just one box, and you go, oh.
Yeah.
Yeah, what's the difference? So you know how, like, most of the really excellent museums, you don't have to pay to get into? And it seems like the worse the museum is, the more you have to pay to get into it.
Yeah.
Why is that?
Yeah, the National Museums in 1999, I think, were all made free.
Yeah.
And, you know, we're paying for them through our taxes, and there's a lot of public funding that goes into it, and we're paying for it, which doesn't happen in a lot of our countries. But if you were running a local museum somewhere, maybe a niche museum somewhere, what happened was that no one had any obligation to fund you anymore, really, because all the money went to the big people. So, yeah, you have to pay £2 to go into the rope museum and see how people used to.
So Blair's government did that?
Yeah, yeah. Right. And they were kind of golden days as a tourism researcher.
Not for the rope museum.
Not for the rope museum.
Yeah. Rope enthusiasts suffering since 99.
But the money that was there for tourism at the time, and it was all tied around this kind of cool Britannia thing, and we were this open country, and come and see all this fantastic stuff. And we haven't got Thatcher anymore, and we've got rid of all the mines, and now we've converted them into industrial heritage museums and opened up all these abandoned warehouses. It's like fantastic.
Come and see Oasis at the Pyramid Centre, all that business.
Yeah.
Come and see the Blue Tones.
And the Millennium Dome, and all this stuff. So, yeah, there was tourism was taken really seriously then. Not so much now.
Does anybody regulate things for tourists in this country? So, for example, you know how every winter there's always the Winterville experiences, and it's just like a thin man in a red cape and his small underfed reindeer.
Yeah.
But you know these things happen and they charge like to come and experience it.
Yeah.
Does anybody regulate that at all?
No, not at all. There's nothing to stop you setting up a Christmas experience in your front room and putting up a sign and getting tourists in. I mean, if you're in Thailand, for instance, you have to have a license to be a tourism business.
Yeah.
And the local tourist authority will check you out. They will manage the quality of what you're doing. If they don't like it, they will shut you down.
Yeah.
But here, we have this free market approach, and anyone can do anything, really. So if you want to open a hotel, well, there's planning law to do that, but it's not tourism law.
Yeah.
If you want to open a restaurant, well, you have to get the right kind of planning permission, and you have to get your health and safety certificate and so on, but it's not a tourism thing.
Yeah.
So no, there's no one actually saying this is a good tourism experience to have and this is a bad one.
If I was a tourist and I came over to the UK and I'd taken the kids to sad Santa Town, and I've paid like my 25 quid each, so I've paid 75 quid to come there, is there any sort of like law that I can, that's on my side as a tourist to get that money back from this crazy old man?
There's consumer protection legislation. So if they were promising an experience that they didn't deliver, so if they said there would be a Father Christmas and there was no Father Christmas, then you could claim your money back. But if you're a tourist, are you really going to go to the small claims court and do that sort of thing? Or if, you know, if you go to someone and it says it's a fantastic experience for all the family and some of your family don't enjoy it, how do you measure that? It's really difficult. So no, there's nothing.
As you're one of your biggest recourses in that free market way that it's being done at the moment, to leave lots of horrible online reviews.
Yeah, I mean,
is that probably one of the most powerful things? Yeah. What ways in which the consumer's most empowered when it comes to tourists?
Yeah, and that in the kind of hospitality industry, that is one of the hottest topics at the moment. Is how do you deal with the fact that customers can walk out and then destroy you online? And maybe they're right, and maybe they're wrong, or maybe they work for the business down the road who wants to destroy you. And there's lots of people paid a lot of money to try and manage the online reputation of places like this. So hotels will employ people to respond to TripAdvisor reviews, and it's mainly TripAdvisor. They will contact people and try and follow up their problems and then try and get them to come back and post a positive review. There's a move in a lot of restaurants to say, we will only deal with reviews where you take a photo of your receipt and upload it to your site and things like this.
See, I find TripAdvisor really interesting because I don't look at it. I think it's ridiculous. Like my father-in-law, when he was trying to find somewhere for us to go out for Christmas dinner, found a place on TripAdvisor. He was like, this place is really highly rated. And I was like, mate, that is a horrible restaurant. I've been there. That's a grotty little... Oh, it's not a good restaurant. Why does anybody even look at TripAdvisor? Because it just seems like absolutely random.
But when people come... When you go to a new destination, it can be really confusing, especially if there are things in different languages and you don't understand the items on the menu. And you can go on TripAdvisor in your own language and see something reassuring that makes you feel like people like me... liked that place.
Yeah.
It's like having a bit of a tour guide. But you know, what I want when I'm looking at hotels is I want filter buttons that say, like, take all the Americans out of this review because they're obsessed with check-in. Take the Brits out because they're just really obsessed with breakfast in a hotel. And if they don't like the breakfast, they will slate the hotel. But I want the reviews from, like, the Dutch and the Italians because they seem to just have a much more balanced view of what eating is about and what a hotel is like. And
let's go to Holland and Italy.
But you don't get those filters, so you're left with this big long list of one star, one star, one star. And then when you look a bit, it's like, I went to my room and there was only three towers and I'd expect four, one star.
Yeah.
And it's pointless.
A friend was telling me that he was looking for a hotel somewhere to go with his boyfriend and it had the one-star review, and he's the kind of guy who reads one-star reviews first, which I think is all wrong. And it said it was full of gays.
Oh. Wow.
So he's like, so we knew it was perfect for us.
and most people are still booking their holidays through the big travel agencies and through the big tour operators. So it's very easy to get into this view that what we're all doing now is we book our flights at one place and we're really price sensitive and we work out where the cheapest flights are, and then we look at TripAdvisor and we find a really good hotel or we find this boutique Airbnb property and then we do this. But actually, most people still go to the TUI website, the Thomas Cook website. They search by price and weather, and then they book whatever has the best weather at the lowest price. Mm. And those sites, they have their own reviews, which they're editing, so you can get a sense, you know, you get a sense of why they're putting them up there. Sometimes they have a bit of TripAdvisor integration, but you're never really sure how much to trust it. But most people are really booking price and weather are the two main things.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra.
Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Given that the tourism industry may be responsible for the end of mankind in the next century with the catastrophic rise in sea levels, where's the best value beach holiday one could get this year if one hadn't booked, say?
I mean, tourism is completely unsustainable as an industry.
Right.
Like almost every other bit of capitalism, it consumes more resources than it can ever create. It has all kinds of negative impacts.
But more coastline, you are making more coastline by raising the sea levels.
Yeah, I mean, it's going to be fantastic for Blackpool.
Yeah.
And just making different coastline.
Slightly further in.
You've got destinations like the Maldives, where 80% of their islands are going to be underwater. That's a massive challenge for them as a destination. How do you cope? But then other places are going to do incredibly well. So places like Albania, who are already seeing a rise in tourism, their climate is going to get more and more favourable and become more like a kind of North African climate for them. That gives them a massive opportunity to expand. So winners and losers.
My fear is that this is going to mean more and more cruise ships, which in turn is the worst possible thing for the environment. So it's just going to exacerbate the problem. I mean, if climate change goes the way it's going, and they're building more and more super cruise ships than ever before.
Yeah.
And they are, like, environmentally and in terms of who are on them, an 100% moral vortex.
But then if we are all herded onto floating city-states, then at least there won't be a big distinction between being on holiday and not. It'll all be the same.
Oh, the
disease.
You sound
like someone who's worked on a cruise ship.
Yeah, I've done.
Do you do comedy on a cruise ship?
Just toured an entire show about how disastrous it was called The Silence of the Nans.
Oh, brilliant.
Yeah.
I've never been on a cruise. I'd like to go as a researcher because I think it would be interesting. But I'd like to be able to go, have a look, and then get off when I chose. I don't think I'd want to be trapped on there for a long time. But cruise is the fastest growing part of the tourism industry. And I think when I was growing up, a cruise was something that people's parents saved their whole lives for.
Yeah.
And then they blew their retirement money on it.
Yeah.
Now, cruises are there and are affordable and are just a kind of mass tourism product. And you can go on a Disney cruise. You can go on all kinds of different themed cruises. Some of them are super luxury. Some of them are really budget. And linked with global warming, new destinations are coming online as well. So, like, cruising to the Arctic Circle is a massive growth area.
See, I'd love to. I don't get cruises at all. It just seems like a hive of disease.
Yeah, it is.
And awful people. But cruising to the Arctic Circle does sound pretty cool.
And there might be more sustainable forms of cruise in the future. I don't want to sound like I'm an apologist for the cruise industry, but I don't think it's going away.
Yeah.
Battery power, I mean, not like Duracell battery power, but these massive new storage batteries, maybe that will help, certainly with the polluting effects of tourism. And places like the Caribbean, where lots of the smaller islands are really inaccessible and they don't have any industry going on at all, really, other than cruise tourism, bringing thousands of people in one go to them on a boat actually is a massive economic benefit for those places. So
depends on the people.
I don't know if you know this. Back before cruises were powered by, pollutants, they used to have these things called sails. They used to just wander around the globe using the power of God. Yeah. Is there no go back to that? And then, I mean, I know a lot of them had slaves in the galley as well.
Someone's rowing.
But if we all took a turn, we all did half an hour a day down in the bottom.
I mean, there is probably someone now somewhere in North London coming up with a vintage sail experience.
So tourist destinations, do they enjoy stag and hen parties or do they hate the fact that this happens?
I
used to live in Brighton and it was awful.
It was awful. Cities like Prague.
Beautiful Prague.
Beautiful, quiet, sleepy Prague. Yeah. They made a conscious decision as a destination in the kind of mid-90s to go for stag and hen parties.
Yeah.
Because they could get low-cost flights, they could bring in loads of people. And actually, those people spent lots of money. You didn't have to spend a lot of money looking after them. because they didn't really want that much or wouldn't really notice if they did have a nice room or not. It's just cheap. And now they're really struggling to say, no, we're about heritage and history and culture and the food is great and we've got craft beer and these kind of things. But yeah, lots of destinations love stag and hen parties, just like some destinations love golf tourism. Destinations like high-spending tourists.
But even at the expense... Because, like Tallinn looks so beautiful.
Yeah.
And I just think it would be full of horrible men.
Yeah.
But if you were that kind of man and you were going on a stag party...
Yeah.
And you know it's going to be full of other stag parties and loads of lads having a brilliant time...
Yeah.
You might think that's the best place to go.
Yeah,
I do. And that's... there are lots of alternatives.
Yeah.
Yeah, when you're choosing some... When you're, as a tourist, when you're choosing somewhere to go... These places, we talk about product substitution in tourism. Like, you don't want to go to Tallinn because it's full of stag parties, but you might go to St. Petersburg because actually that's on the same kind of circuit, but it's more cultural and historical and has those kind of things going on. Actually, the product when you get there is quite similar. It's the same kind of prices, the flight time's not very different, all this kind of stuff. You don't have to go to these places where the stag parties are, and lots of places see them as a way to get loads of money in quickly. But then I think you get a kind of buyer's regret kicking in 10 years later, where actually you realise that you now have a workforce that only really knows how to deal with stag parties.
There's a lot of stuff that you've made me think of there in the news at the moment about how 18 to 30 packages are going under and 18 to 30 companies are selling that brand because millennials aren't buying into that. Is that something you've noticed?
Is it because of chlamydia?
Well, it's never put Brits off before, I don't think. But
yeah, why is 18 to 30 dying? Because when I was younger, that always, I mean, it's never really attracted me, but I'm not a very sexual person. But like some people that I went to school with, they could not wait to turn 18 to go on Club 1830 holidays.
Yeah, it's gone out of fashion, and it's just there are lots of trends in the tourism industry, and it's just one of those things that has just gone out of fashion. It used to be that if you were 18, you were either going to buy an Interrail ticket because you had that kind of background and that kind of school where people
middle
said
class.
You're basically going and doing the grand tour around Europe on a budget, or you were 18, you were going to Magaluf.
Yeah.
And that kind of split people. Now there are so many more options and people are so much more used to travelling. It's so much more accessible. It's so much cheaper that 18 to 30 and Interrail, they're just little bits of a market and you can do so many different things. But then also young people just don't have any money.
Yes.
Like, if your product is aimed at 18 to 30 year olds, well, you're aiming at the market that has the lowest disposable income in Europe. We have a lot of students with us who work on kind of developing business plans and developing new business ideas. And because they're young, they always think, I want to aim this product at people like me.
Yeah.
And we're constantly saying to them, no, like, go for the over 50s. Because they've got the disposable income. They've got
all the
time.
Houses.
They own the houses. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So but they can deal with this stuff.
You're suggesting that we come up with some sort of Viagra holiday, which is like Club 1830, but for the 65 plus.
Yeah,
and it's basically booze and sex.
Yeah, cruises.
Yeah.
Cruises.
They can say that till they die.
Yeah.
Yeah. That seems like an open goal.
Yeah. And then a lot of places you go to, like Southeast Asia, you can quite easily stumble into kind of expat communities who are all retirees and they've got their pension from France and they're living in Bali. And yeah, they are the ones who are going to these exotic destinations and living the kind of backpacker lifestyle and having the parties and having the fun and maybe having the sex. Wasn't that kind of holiday for me? But
old people love sex.
Yeah,
I'll say it now.
Yeah, but they're off doing these things, and young people just aren't so much.
Do you have another question, Jess?
I've always wanted to know why are hotels so expensive to sleep in, but the staff are all either on minimum wage or are child slaves. I grew up in a touristy town, as I said, my first few jobs were on £3 an hour and under in
various did you grow
hotels.
Up?
Swanage in Dorset.
Oh, okay. My first job was in a hotel.
Yeah.
Hotels, hospitality is really good at creating low-paid, entry-level, low-skill jobs. And that's important because...
I was actually a very skillful chambermaid.
I was a really bad waiter. But it's really important to have those things in the economy because... Not everybody has postgraduate education and not everybody can work full time. People have different kinds of responsibilities. So you can create jobs that can be part time and low skill. That can be really important. So that's So there are lots of low-skilled jobs in hotels, and that's not necessarily a bad thing.
I think I don't mean just the low-skilled jobs. Mm. I worked in a very successful, packed hotel that had huge weddings in it and stuff, and a very popular, very good restaurant that wasn't just for guests. Mm. And even the head chef and that guy that was running the whole, you know, the manager and stuff, the owners must have been raking it in. Was that? And that felt like that was... I got the impression from my seniors that weren't the owners that that's just what happens in hospitality.
Yeah. I mean, that's how Tesco runs as well.
I suppose.
If you're 16 and you get a job in a hotel and it's a local independent hotel run by a local businessman, the profit margins are actually really tiny.
Okay.
Really?
Hotels are really expensive to run and they're empty most of the time. In London, if your hotel is 50% full, you're doing really well. If it's 80% full, you're probably having all kinds of crises because you haven't got enough staff to run it.
Is that because of the proliferation of Airbnb and people privately renting out their that cities are struggling like that? Or is that just because it's a bit chicken and egg? Like, they can't keep them full because people have got so many options.
Yeah.
They have to keep themselves really expensive.
It's that. It's that actually building a hotel is a massive sunk cost. It costs you millions to if you're building a hotel from scratch, buying the land, installing everything, fitting it out, it all has to be super high spec, and most of the time it's going to be empty. So hotel rooms, going back to what you said, hotel rooms are often really, really expensive because they're trying to pull back all these really sunk costs. And the easiest way to cut your costs is on your staff.
Okay.
On the other side of things, you can get hotel rooms really, really cheaply if you know how to do it.
Tell me.
How do you do it?
Yeah. You just have to spend hours on websites and you have to just be really geeky about it and know the right times to
book. Booking.com and all of those
things.
What's the right time to book?
Tuesdays.
That's same for flights.
Are you serious?
Everyone's just going to write this down now. Tuesdays, people don't tend to book on a Tuesday. You get better offers on Tuesdays. You get really bad offers at impulse buying times, kind of like 1 o'clock in the morning on a Saturday morning when people have come home and think, let's go on holiday. You get really bad offers then.
That's when I finish work, so I often do it then.
And then you have to clear the
finishing
cookies.
Work, lunch breaks. Don't never book anything in your lunch break.
You have to clear the cookies as well from your search engine because it knows that you've been back to the website.
Yeah, people say that. All the research says that's probably not true. But one thing that does seem to work is if you just kind of leave stuff in your basket and then don't do anything and then you get an email a week later saying, we've noticed you've been to our website, here's a 10% discount. That happens quite a lot. But hotels have this massive operating cost, which means that if they are really empty, they'd rather have you paying 50% of the cost than have nothing in.
Yeah.
Because they've got their staff and so on.
Yeah.
But that doesn't get around the fact that some of those jobs are really poorly paid. Some of them are on 0 hours contracts and that sort of thing. And that's all just awful. That just shouldn't happen. But, capitalism.
Jessica, have you got a final question?
I've got a final question. Why does foreign cash feel so very, very much easier and more fun to spend?
Okay, I've only got a really pseudo-intellectual answer to this, I'm afraid.
That's fine.
Because the simple answer is because most of the time we've had a drink and it's always easier to spend money when you've had a drink. But I think the kind of researchy answer is a lot of people talk about this idea that when you're on holiday, you're not at home, you're not at work, you're in some kind of weird middle ground. And people talk about it as these kind of liminal experiences or these carnivalesque experiences.
What does liminal mean?
So liminal is this idea that you're not in one position or another. So a limen is a Latin word and it means like a doorway or a border. And when you're caught in between, you're not really bound by the rules of either place. So when you're on holiday, you will try food you've never tried before. Yeah. You will wear less clothes. Fewer clothes, less clothes. Yeah. Not as much clothes as you normally do. People will engage in sexual behaviour they wouldn't normally do at home. People will get random tattoos. All these things that you can only really explain as a kind of moment of temporary madness, they seem to happen on holiday all the time. And so there's this idea of the liminal.
Is that why people get engaged there?
Yeah. People make impulse decisions. People decide to go bungee jumping off the side of some dodgy old building. They would never do that at home. But when you're on holiday, normal rules don't apply. And money's like that. It's not real money. It's holiday money. And who knows what the euro exchange rate really is? I mean, it's not as good as it used to be, but nobody really knows. So that's not really a pound. It's only up
to 70 pence. I wondered whether it was just
confusion.
Secretly, most people are terrible at maths.
Yeah.
But surely there are whole holiday destinations which are built around not putting people in a liminal state and going, it's exactly like your house. You won't have to try foreign food. You won't have to have any exciting experiences. It's going to be like your house, but sunny.
Yeah, that's what a lot of people want. And you can split tourists along this kind of spectrum from the people who want to do crazy stuff to the people who just want some better weather, but they want everything else to be the same. And that explains why Benidorm is such a big destination. Because you can go there with people you know, meet other people just like you, but the great thing is you don't have to go to work the next morning. And that's enough of a break for a lot of people. The weather's nicer, you've still got your access to healthcare, you don't have to worry about these things.
Oh, and that's a brilliant reason for going. Just a class-defied thing, no, I don't think. There are very high-end ways of going somewhere to do nothing.
Yeah, if you're used to living in a luxury environment, you can go and live in another luxury environment. Great, if you've got a concierge in your Riverside development in London, where you can go and stay in a hotel that has a reception, and actually you're very used to those kind of interactions.
I feel genuinely more relaxed just hearing you talk about that. The idea of a concierge.
I find it odd that people like better weather. I only ever go on holiday to cold places.
Yeah,
hate wearing bikinis. Anyway, Nat, have you got a question?
Yes. Often in stories and films and things, you'll see a town building something for tourism.
Mm-hmm.
And it'll go horribly wrong. But has there ever been anyone who's built something so bad it was essentially reverse tourism and driven people away?
Oh, God, I don't know.
Like, say, Crawley's first rat crematorium.
And the problem is you'd never find out. I mean, you got that kind of the Banksy Dismaland thing. Was that in Weston? Was it Weston City Mare? And to build a theme park that was so kind of dystopian that no one would like it, in the full knowledge that everyone would come because it was so awful and it was so cool to go. But I don't know if anyone's ever built an attraction so bad it sent people away. So bad that no one would ever go there again.
You can't do one bad enough that people won't come.
Yeah, because it'll go round the horseshoe to ironically call you.
I would be there. Yeah, if it was that bad.
It would have to be boring. My final question is: who visits stately homes and why? Who visits stately? Do people visit stately homes?
Yeah,
why?
People love the stately homes. They are the most important part of our tourism industry, probably.
No,
it's when you ask international tourists, why did you come to the UK? It's the heritage, it's the historic buildings, and they're not just talking about coming and standing outside, you know, Westminster. They're talking about visiting the kinds of places they've seen in adaptations of Jane Austen things. It's coach loads of tourists being bussed out of London to go to places in like Kent and Surrey to just go and be in an old building. And, you know, I think as domestic tourists, I think we think about these things much more in terms of like the National Trust and English Heritage and like take your own flask and have a picnic. Whereas international tourists see this much more of here's a chance to be in these amazing buildings, which they basically think they're all palaces.
Which stately home is the most haunted?
Ooh.
Which one's got the most ghosts?
The most, God.
Come on, as a tourism expert, you must know where all the ghosts are.
He's not going to let that out.
No, but the thing is, I do research dark tourism, which is like tourism associated with death and disaster and things like that. One of the bits of research that was really interesting a few years ago from Visit Britain was about tourists from China and some other East Asian tourists, Vietnamese tourists, for example, who didn't like to stay in big old country house hotels because they're worried about ghosts.
Well, and High Spirits is basically a documentary.
And they preferred to stay in, like, a Novotel. Because at least it was all new and clean and friendly. But it had the most haunted house. Yeah. It'd be in Pluckley, in Kent. That's where the ghosts are.
Well, thank you very much. Have you got anything to plug, Nat?
Oh, yes. I'm crowdfunding a book, please, Unbound. It's called Dishonourable Member.
What's it about?
Mm. It's the fictional diaries of the MP character I've been doing for ages.
Oh. That sounds fabulous. Jessica, have you got anything to plug?
I have. I've got a podcast all about eating called Hoovering. Lots of interesting conversations into eating.
Why is it called Hoovering?
It's a slang term for eating.
I'd never heard. And James, have you got anything to plug?
On the 4th and the 5th of June at the University of Greenwich, we're hosting the Tourism Symposium, which is the Tourism Society for the UK's annual get-together. Loads of industry people talking about tourism in the UK. It goes on for 2 or 3 days. It'll be fantastic. Come to that.
Thank you very much. Thanks to my guests, James Cannell, Jessica Foster Q, and Nat Tapley. Any Stupid Questions was written and presented by me, Danielle Ward, and produced by Ed Morrish. You can follow us on Twitter at AnyStupidQs. And of course, you can tell everyone in the world about us via the usual methods. Thank you for listening. Goodbye. Hopefully, my throat will be better next episode, unless this is the last episode, in which case, it'll be better by the next series.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns. Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.